Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Patty, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Sarah for allowing me to come out here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. So if you have a problem with it, talk to her. My sobriety date, I'm sick. I just went to the doctor today. I can barely breathe. So hopefully I won't, like, die as I'm up here. But they put me on steroids. So I'm, like, really shaky and, like, really sweaty. So this should be fun. My sobriety date is June 10, 2002. I have a sponsor. Her name is Vicky. She knows she is my sponsor. I have a home group. It's White Rose. We meet Friday night at 8 o'clock. We're a speakers meeting. I am the speaker getter there. It's the best meeting in New York. It's not the best meeting in the world, but it is the best meeting in New York. So if you're ever in New York on a Friday night, come over, because we always have a message of hope. And some of you have spoke there. Amber has spoken there. Thank you very much for coming out. And I forget where I was. and I have the honor and privilege of helping others in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really the bright spot of my life, because I am so selfish, right, and so consumed with myself, and I think about myself all the time, that when I'm helping others, I can't do this the same. I can't think about myself and them at the same time. So that has really saved my life. It really has. You know, when they talk about in the big book, when it says intensive, nothing will assure immunity against drinking is intensive work with others. It's absolutely the truth. It's my experience. Because a couple times, like a lot of times, throughout my sobriety, I was very self-consumed. All I did was think about me. And thank God the phone rang, or I showed up to a meeting and somebody needed help. And I had to postpone thinking about myself for a little bit, you know. And it got me through the rough spots. But I was born and raised in New Jersey. I'm Irish Catholic. Well, I was Catholic, but I'm not anymore. And you would think all that stuff makes me an alcoholic. And guess what? It does. No. It doesn't. I used to think it was the reason I was, like, so messed up. But what makes me an alcoholic is I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. Once I put any alcohol in my system, it sets off a phenomenon of craving. And once I start, I can't stop. When I do stop, all I do is think about it until I pick it up again. You know, I've lost the ability to control my drinking. That's what makes me an alcoholic. Not all the crazy stuff I did and all my marriages and all the states, none of that stuff makes me an alcoholic. But it made for an interesting life, I could tell you that. So I had a dad, right, who was drunk around the clock. And he was so, so fabulous. He was funny. He was sarcastic. I loved him. He was my hero. I wanted to be just like him. I couldn't wait to go to the places and do the things that he did because he looked like he was having a good time. I had a mother who did not drink. She was not funny or sarcastic or fabulous. And she really needed a drink. Like, I wish I could have got her to drink before she died, but... But I never wanted to be like my mom. And as I examine my experience and my life, my mother was awesome, you know. She took care of the kids. She was a loving, kind, spiritual woman who gave. And it wasn't forced to give, or it just came natural to her. But at the time, I wanted nothing to be like my mother, and I was nothing like my mother. And I couldn't wait to go to where my father went to, because I don't really have a lot of memories of my childhood. The only memories I have is when I was with my dad at the bar. I loved it. It was dark. It was smoky. It was dirty. The jukebox was playing. I loved it, you know. And I have two older brothers and a younger sister. I don't remember them at all. So I was self-centered from the very beginning. I just remember me, you know. And it's so crazy. Like, I don't remember them. And I was just filled with fear. Absolutely filled with fear my whole life. You know, I just was terrified. And I could actually put words to that, because I remember just saying to my mother, I'm so scared, I'm afraid, you know. And she just thought, like, I was mental. But But I remember, like, when I was, well, I don't remember, but I was told when I was 3 years old, I got really sick and I almost died. And I was in the hospital and they didn't know what was wrong with me. And finally, they found out that I had encephalitis, which is a sleeping sickness which affects your brain. So all these years, my father just thought I was, like, retarded, you know what I mean? But really what I suffered from was a spiritual malady. And I just looked retarded, you know? So from a very young age, I was different, you know? And they thought it was because of this, but really what it was is because I had a spiritual malady. I was disconnected. And I didn't know it. I just knew I was afraid. And I couldn't wait to grow up so I could drink. And I wouldn't have to listen to anybody anymore. But at the age of 14, my best friend, she went to her cousin's house in Jersey City that weekend, and she drank. And she said, "We can't even wait for the weekend. We got to go." So we cut school. And I could not wait to get there. And we got there, and we started to drink. And I tell you what happened is I experienced my very first spiritual awakening. Became comfortable in my own skin. I could look you in the eye, care less what you thought about me. It was, my head was attacking me so much that I didn't even know it until it quieted down. Immediately after that, I became extremely seductive. My clothes came off and I went to a blackout. And that's how I drank from the very beginning to the very end. Except towards the end, I wasn't seductive, but I was definitely naked. I was, like, so free. Like, I just wanted to be naked, you know? And I found something that day that worked. And I was never, ever going to wait for anybody ever to offer me alcohol ever again. I was going to chase this. I lived around up the street from a liquor store. I would take my lunch money every day, and I'd get old men to buy me alcohol. So it was a daily drink from the very beginning. And I had to be. It was the only thing that worked, that felt made me feel whole and connected and complete, even if it was only for a brief moment, and it stopped my head. And then I'd overshoot the mark and wound up in a blackout naked, you know, and it'd be over and over and over again. And I got in a lot of trouble. When you're 14 and naked, you get in a lot of trouble, you know, and I didn't care. It was well worth it for me to feel okay in my own skin. But at the age of 14, it was Memorial Day weekend. I stood out in front of a liquor store, and I got some old men to buy me alcohol, and we were all going to the beach, And when you're drinking on lunch money, you don't get a lot, you know. But I ran into these two guys, right, who wanted to know if I wanted to do more drinking with them. And I said, absolutely. And I wound up leaving the beach and jumping in the car with these two guys who I had no idea who they were, nor did I care. All I knew is that I was going to be drinking more. And what happened that day changed my world. And what happened that day, I wound up getting brutally beaten and raped, which doesn't make me an alcoholic. I thought that did, too. But that day I became a victim, and everybody knew I was a victim. And I was a victim of that until I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I couldn't see back then how I made decisions based on self that later put me in the position to be harmed. And my family, I had convinced my family that if they were raped, they would need to drink. And they agreed with me. So at a very young age, I was basically allowed to drink the way I needed to drink. And the school had me to all kinds of therapists and psychiatrists, and my family sent me to them. I went to hundreds of them. And they started putting me on medications because they said I was very depressed. And they would say stuff like, "Now, Patty, this is going to triple the effect of alcohol." And I was like, that is so fabulous, you know what I mean? So I take my meds. And especially when you're drinking on lunch money, you get into a blackout real quick, right? And I love the blackouts because when I was blacked out, I felt like I was invisible, you know, and nothing could touch me. And then I'd wake up and I'd be, like, horrified, and it would be over and over again. But I did graduate high school with a note from one of my many, many psychiatrists that said that if I didn't graduate high school, I'd have a breakdown. And they just wanted me out of there, so they graduated me. And I got that diploma, and I was walking across that stage drunk out of my mind. I fell off the stage. My mother was not impressed with me. And I was 18 years old, and she said, "It's time for you to go. You're 18, you graduated, see you later." And I was so glad to get out of there, and I left home, and I moved in with a go-go dancer. And I was supposed to watch her son while she danced that night, and my life became very unmanageable. I started getting arrested, DUI, stuff like that. And I started feeling like I didn't have a real reason and purpose for living. But what I always wanted to be was a mom. I never wanted to get married, and I never wanted to go to college. I couldn't go to college. Can't go to college when you graduate with no credits. But what I wanted to do was be a mom. Because, you know, I would have a reason and purpose for living. I would have someone to love, someone to always love me. And so that's what I set out to do. I set out to get pregnant. And I found a really, really dumb guy. Really dumb. And he's still dumb to this day. At a party. And I got pregnant. And my mother was really upset. I was raised Catholic, like I said. And she thought it was best if I married this guy. And I didn't want to get married, but I already caused enough damage, so I figured I'd marry him. I won't stay married, but I'll marry him. And so one of my many, many psychiatrists, one of them happened to be a reverend, so my psychiatrist married me. And this is how my dad describes me. My dad describes me if I was in Chase Stadium, it was filled with brain surgeons, that I pick up the hot dog vendor. And he was a hot dog vendor, right? But I had this little girl, right, that I love with all my heart and soul. And I just wanted to be the best mom. And the hot dog vendor got a job one day. I think the only job he's ever gotten in his life. And he went off to work and I left. And I took my little girl. And I took off to California and I came back to Jersey because I had nobody to watch her until I could drink in California. And I did want to be the best mom. And she had the best clothes. She went to the best daycares. Like, I was so young. I was like 18, 19 years old. Like, I didn't even know what to do with her. Like, I would take her and get her nails done. Like, she's two. You know what I mean? Get her nails done, you know? It was a mess. But I loved her with all my heart and soul. And what she had was a lot of outside stuff. But what she didn't have was a mom. And I had this job, and I drop her off, and I worked hard, and I deserved to drink. Look at the good job I'm doing. At the end of the year, I get a really big income tax check because now I have a kid, and I take that little girl, and I drop her off with the hot dog vendor, and I go on vacation, and I leave her behind because the good job I'm doing, I deserve this. So I got to go to a lot of places. I don't really remember a lot of anything except the one year when I was vacationing in Southern California, I met this Marine, and he was so hot. And he was stationed in Southern California, and he was from Minnesota. And he was really athletic. I'm not athletic to this day. Am I ever athletic ever? But what I wanted to do was just impress him, like I wanted to do with everybody. See, what I was so empty, and I was so lost, and I didn't know who I was. And the only time I felt even okay is when I was drunk. And then I'd overshoot the mark once again, you know, and wind up in a blackout. But what I wanted to do was I wanted him to think I was, like, fabulous. And so he's, like, into all these sports, you know what I mean, like hockey and skiing, you know. And so I live in Jersey and he lives in California. And so what I tell him is I tell him I'm an expert skier because I want him to like me. And so I get back to Jersey, and he calls me up, and he was really impressed by me because he said, you know what, Patty, I'm going to come to Jersey, and I'm going to take you skiing in Vermont. And I thought, that is so fabulous because I never drank in Vermont. My plan was to get him good and loaded because who wants to ski when you could drink, right? So we get to Vermont, and he really wants to ski, and I never skied. To this day, have I ever skied, but I can't tell him that. Because I'm a liar, you know, and I want to impress him. So I go along with it, and we're on the expert hill going up the lift, and I'm terrified, and I'm shaking. And he's like, you are right. I said, just haven't skied in a while. We get all the way up to the top. Some of you have obviously have skied. Get all the way up to the top. High. I can't even believe how high it is. I am like, I don't even know how I'm going to pull this off. But we get up there, and I don't know how to get off the ski lift. I barely got on the ski lift, you know what I mean? So I fall off the ski lift. I get tangled up around the poles. I have to shut down the whole ski lift, untangle me. And I said to him, I said, you know what? Go ahead and ski because I haven't skied in a while. I'll just meet you down at the end of the mountain. He took off skiing because he skis. And I took off rolling, climbing, crawling. 4 hours later, I got down to the bottom of that mountain. And that is a perfect example of some of the stuff I get myself jammed up in because I'm a liar and I'm trying to impress you and I don't know who I am. You know, and I can't tell you that I'm a liar after I just told you this fabulous story about myself, you know what I mean? And what happens is every time my life gets unmanageable, what I think I need is just one more baby. If I have one more baby, I'll be okay. By the time I'm pregnant with my third daughter, I cannot stop drinking. The first two pregnancies, I was able to stop. And I have a priest bless the baby inside me because I'm Catholic. And I have holy water blessed by the Pope that I put on my stomach every day. And I have prayer services going on all over the country. And I can't stop drinking. I could do all those things, but I can't stop drinking. Every day I get up and I promise myself I'm not going to drink today. Because I don't want to hurt my baby. And every day I wound up in a blackout. And the day she came, I was terrified to have her because I didn't know what I did to her. My best friend came with me. And when the doctor delivered her and went to hand her to me, I wouldn't take her because I was scared. And they handed her to my best friend. And when I seen my best friend smile, I knew she was okay. And I got to tell you, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew it. Every day I tried so hard not to drink. And every day I wound up in a blackout. And I knew my life was unmanageable. And it's not even the DUIs and all that crazy stuff. It's all the stuff that goes on the inside. It's all the stuff they talk about on page 52 of the big book. You know, it was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't seem to make a living. My personal relationships were a mess. But I tell you, it took me many years after that to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I wound up marrying my two youngest daughter's father. And he's a chef, so he's upgrade hot dog vendor. And he's a good chef. You know, he'd send out his resume. They come and they pack us up and they move us to whatever resort he was working at. And they get to wherever we went. Never wanted to be married. Never acted like a married woman. My husband would get horrified. He'd send out his resume. They pack him up and the kids. And they go off to wherever. And I'd stay behind in whatever state we were in. And I would play and have fun until I started missing my kids and I'd follow behind. And towards the end of my drinking, we live in Georgia. And I'm a mess. I'm such a mess. We have this restaurant, and I'm absolutely out of control. I remember, like, one night I came to, right, and had no idea where I was, and I have no idea where my children are. And I get up, and I realize I'm in my bedroom, and I'm walking down the hall, and I'm praying, please, God, please let my children be okay, and please let them be here. And I'll never drink again because I don't even know where they are. I'm scared to death. And I'm walking down the hallway, and I get to their bedroom, and I open the door. And my little girls are safely sleeping in their bed. And what I do is I go straight to the kitchen, and I pour myself a drink. And I'm out of control, and I'm having an affair again with a young guy who works in the kitchen, and my husband's had it with me. And this is how my relationship with my ex-husband was. He was very abusive. He was mentally, physically, and sexually abusive. And by no means do I think I'm a victim. Obviously, look at what I do. But I know one thing. Like, if I push him hard enough and I'm drunk and I set him off, he'll, like, hit me. Or what he'll do is he'll lock me in the bedroom with him for 3 hours and scream at me and tell me what a piece of shit I am for 3 hours. And then he'd feel really bad. And he'd leave me alone for at least a week so I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And I was willing to take a beating to drink the way I wanted to drink. But this day, he comes home and he knows I'm having an affair. And he's tired of my crap. And he drags me from the kitchen into the bedroom. And he gets on top of me and he strangles me till I pass out. And I come to. And he says to me, he said, Patty, if you're ever afraid of me, tonight's the night to be afraid of me because I'm going to kill you. And I could tell you, I seen something different in his eyes and I knew he meant it. And he started strangling me again until I almost passed out. And he just fell off of me. And I got away and I called the police. And the police came and they arrested him. And he's in jail with serious charges. He was charged with kidnapping from taking me from one room to another. He was charged with attempted murder and rape. And attempt rape. So he's has high bail. He's locked away in jail. And I got this restaurant to run with a little boyfriend in the kitchen who has no idea what he's doing. And I'm a mess. It's Christmas time. I've got all these parties. And I just drank, like I do every day. And one day the police called, and they said my husband was bailed out of jail, and he was going back home to pack up his stuff because he had to leave. And I started thinking, as I was drinking that day, that what my real problem was Georgia. I think I just really need to get my kids and get back to Jersey, and how I'm going to be okay. And so I packed my kids up in the car, and I was already drunk. I had about 6 bottles of wine. Not that I'm a big beer and wine drinker, but that's all my restaurant had was a beer and wine license. And I stopped, and I got a 100-proof bottle of vodka. I was going to pack the car with the kids, and I was going to head back to Jersey. And what happened is I came to, and the house was filled with the police, and it was filled with the neighbors. And my husband was not only packing up his stuff, but he was packing up my little girl's stuff. And the police said that my little girls were better off with him, who just was charged with all these serious charges, than a drunk as a mother. Because it was absolutely true. Because I endangered their lives every single day. I would drive in blackouts every day. And I would total the car and crash into trees and run over rail trucks and blow out the tires of my car. My little girls were terrified. I did it every single day. I endangered their lives. And thank God I never did anything to hurt them. Besides emotionally, you know. And then one day, it was a Saturday, it was 8 o'clock in the morning, I remember, I pulled into the restaurant parking lot, and there was a tree in the parking lot, and I hit this tree. And my youngest daughter was 4 years old at the time, and she jumped out of the car, and she ran into the restaurant because her father was already there. And she said, "Daddy, I'm really afraid. Mommy's acting weird again. She just fell asleep, and she hit a tree, and I'm so afraid, Daddy." And I got into that restaurant, and he started yelling and screaming at me. And what I did is I looked at my little 4-year-old straight in the eyes, and I said to her, "See what you did?" Because I really believed everybody else was the problem. I didn't know it was me. And I knew he had nowhere to go with those little girls, so I left. My favorite speaker in the whole world is from California, and he talks about how he comes to on a bus with his little girl, and she's crying, and she's holding her stomach, and she's shaking. And he says to her, "What's the matter, honey?" And she said, "Daddy, you forgot to feed me today. I'm so hungry." So they get to a rest stop. And he goes in, he gets a bottle of wine, he gets a sandwich, and when he gets up to the counter, he only has enough money for one. And he puts back her sandwich. And that's the kind of drunk I was. And I got to tell you, I love my kids with all my heart and soul. And if there was ever, ever a human power that was going to get me sober, it would have been my little girls. And so I left, because he had no place to go with those little girls. And I left, and I toured through St. Petersburg, Florida. And I was, like, relieved. Like, he's gone, thank God. The kids are gone. Now we can drink. And that's what I did. And I got to the point where I couldn't go 20 minutes without a drink because I would shake violently. And if I did stop, my head and my heart would attack me so bad that I wouldn't even know what else to do but to take a drink. And I weighed 80 pounds. And I'm bruised from head to toe from falling. And I'm yellow. And I have this long hair. And it's fallen out, and I have bald patches all over my head. And I'm a mess. And I have nowhere to go. And I wound up back in Georgia, and I wound up moving into this crack hotel. And I just want to die. Because every day is so hard for the things that I had to do each and every single day to get a bottle of vodka. And that's not how I was raised. And I just felt like I was so dead inside. I felt like I had no soul left. And I didn't know women that drank like the way I did. And I didn't know women that were doing the things that I was doing. But what I thought I heard somewhere is that people who smoke crack are doing these things, you know. And I'm living in a crack hotel, so I might start feeling a little bit better about myself if I start smoking some of this crack, you know what I mean? So that's what I set out to do, is to smoke crack, and I was better at skiing than smoking crack. Way too drunk to smoke crack, pushers and all kinds of shit involved, and I couldn't do it. And the crackheads absolutely hated me. Can you imagine crackheads hating you not even smoking their shit? What crackheads do, some of you may know this, right? Crackheads smoke crack, and then they hide. And they don't want to be found. I would find them. They'd be like, "Just give her back her bottle," you know. But I can't take the things that I'm doing. You know, I tried to become a drug addict. I'm way too drunk to be a drug addict. But across the street from this crack hotel was this car dealership. And when I opened the restaurant, like, I had, like, the grand opening. I had, like, the priest bless the place, and I had the mayor cut the ribbon, you know. So I went over and I talked to the mayor, because he owned this car lot across the street from the crack hotel. And because I can't work in the public anymore, the condition of me, you know. And so he gave me a job detailing cars, so I didn't have to be in the public. I could drink the way I was drinking, you know. And I was spraying, like, hoses and rainbows, and life was good. And I moved out of that crack hotel, and I moved into a trailer park, and I came into work, and things were looking up for me. And I came into work one day, and I have no idea why I have these keys, but I have these keys at home, and they belong to this van. And the mayor says, we're selling that vehicle today. Run home and get those keys. Grab something off the lot. So I run home, grab this big red truck. I go home, and I figured I might as well have a few more drinks while I'm home, you know what I mean? Make the day go quicker. 6 drinks later, I'm like, holy shit, I got to get back. So I start rushing to get back. And I come to, and the truck is totaled. And there's police, fire engines, and ambulance. And they put me right into the ambulance, took me off to the hospital where they put 150 stitches in my face. And from there, they took me off to jail. When I got to jail, I was so relieved. So relieved. Because that was my fifth DUI. And I really believed that the only way I could ever stop drinking is if I was locked away. Because the state of New Jersey has sent me to AA. I don't ever remember hearing a message. I wasn't looking for a message. I wasn't looking to stop. You know what I mean? I just felt sorry for you people. And really what I really thought is that if you drank like me, you wouldn't be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'd be drinking. You know? So I didn't believe you. So I really believed they needed to be locked away. And eventually my father bailed me out. Because he kept calling. I wouldn't get on the phone with him. I didn't want to be bailed out. But eventually he bailed me out. I lost my job detailing cars, seeing rainbows, you know. And now I'm at this trailer park doing the same things I'm doing in that hotel. And what happens is the alcohol stops working. No matter how much I put in my body, it doesn't stop my head anymore. And every day is so hard for what I have to do. And I'm tired and I'm lonely. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the loneliness that only another alcoholic knows. And I miss my kids. And I'm so tired. And I don't want to sell my soul one more day for a bottle of vodka. After I was raped, I asked my mother, why would God let this happen to me? And this is what my mother believed. My mother believed that the more pain we endure, the closer we get to God. So my mother told me, she said, God's not punishing you. He's just making you stronger. So all these years, as I'm making decisions based on self that are later putting me in the position to be harmed, I think I'm getting closer to get to God. And I thought God was so far out there that I would have to pray to the saints to get to God. And I would pray to St. Jude. He's the patron saint of hopeless and despair cases. And I would pray to him all the time. And this day, I didn't say a prayer to St. Jude. I said a prayer to God. And I said, God, you got to help me because I can't get any stronger. And I took a bottle of Tylenol PM and I drank whatever vodka I had left. And I came to on June 10, 2010, in intensive care. My family flew in because they said my father was going to have to take me home in a body bag. And they took all kinds of tests. You know, it was a mess. And eventually they came back that I had no damage at all. And so there they shipped me off to a mental hospital, not a psych ward, like a whole hospital. Loved it. Favorite part of getting sober. Mental ward. And I loved it there, you know. I felt like right at home. But they kept me there until I could stop shaking long enough till they can get me on a plane and get me back to Jersey and get me into this rehab. And I remember getting off the plane, right, and all the bloat was completely off me. And you could see every bone in my body. And had the long hair with the bald patches and I'm yellow. And my family's looking at me like, oh my God, she's dying. And I'm thinking to myself, they are so jealous of me. I like look like a model up here, you know? and they got me into this rehab, right? And it was still so shaky. Like, I went through 3 natural labors. This detox was way worse than that. And I'm still so shaky. They want me to do workbooks and worksheets. And I can't read and I can't write. And I can't tell them that I can't read or write because I'm embarrassed. And I can't even hold a pencil and I can't even think, you know what I mean? And so I have 7 days. My husband's insurance would cover 7 days, and they took me up into the my counselor took me up into the office, and they were going to try to get me some funding. And they went through my workbooks and my worksheets, and nothing was completed. And they said I wasn't serious about recovery and I needed to go. And I started to cry because I had nowhere to go. And I never wanted to go back to where I was, and I never wanted to give away those kids and give away my soul and do any of those things. And I begged them, please help me. And what they decided to do with me, they decided to send me to York, Pennsylvania. They said I was going to go to a recovery house. And I don't even know what a recovery house is, you know what I mean? I've been to AA like a couple times. I don't even know what anything is. And I thought a recovery house was for women who got out of jail for murder and would probably be beating me up. And I was still willing to go because I had nowhere to go, you know? So I get to York and I'm terrified. And I walk into this house, right? And there's this girl who lives there, and she's on the phone, and she's talking to someone. She stops dead in her tracks. She takes one look at me. She gets back on the phone. She's like, holy shit, this one is a real doozy. I think she has wet brain. I don't even know what brain is. I got it, though, right? Showing up to meetings. I have no idea what's going on. People are talking in a different language to me. And and I felt like I'd gone too far for the things that I did. And I get back home, and I say to her, Joni, are you sure? I have wet brain. She says, oh, yeah, pretty sure you have wet brain. Not only that, everybody in AA is talking about you. And I knew they were all looking at me, right? She said, they're all calling you Skeletor. And I have nowhere to go. I just keep showing up. One of the rules of the house is you have to get a sponsor, do a 90-90, a home group, a job. And so I know nothing about sponsors, you know what I mean? So my friend Gangster introduces me to this woman who's going to be my sponsor. And so so now I got a sponsor, you know, calling her every day, and I'm telling her, like, I want to kill people, I want to kill myself. And she's like, what's wrong with you, right? And I call her up, and I say, like, they just question me. On my 15 items or less, I'm going to kill them. And she's like, there's something wrong with you. Well, what this woman did, she passed on to me what was passed on to her, and she did the very best she could. She said, we're going to, and at this time, right, it was really weird, right? There was these people, right, from Baltimore, right, that were coming into York AA with the big book, destroying AA, right? So you weren't allowed to have one of those sponsors. And I'm going to do the right thing, right? I want to stay sober. I'm not going to get these people who are destroying AA as a sponsor, right? And so this woman was taking me through the steps, right? But it wasn't out of the big book, so I was safe, right? And she said I was going to do a sex inventory, right? And she said I was going to write down every single person I've slept with. Can you imagine? Meanwhile, right? So I'm, like, horrified, right? I am horrified that I'm an alcoholic, right? I live in a recovery house. I will never tell anybody because I'm so, like, embarrassed by this, right? I finally get this job, right, and I'm working at this Denny's, right, and I'm working on the people I slept with, right, and I don't tell anybody there that I'm an alcoholic and I live in a recovery house, but I'm standing at the hostess station with this girl, right, and in walks this guy from Jersey, and I said to her, oh, my God, I slept with him and I didn't put him on the list. She's like, you keep a list? I was horrified, right? Horrified. I was like, you don't? She's like, no. Absolutely horrible. So I get together with this woman to do my fifth step, right? And this is what she tells me. She tells me, I'm like, meanwhile, I start thinking, I'm probably not even an alcoholic. I'm probably just like mental. I'm playing like sleep and sickness. It's like killing me right now, right? You know, with encephalitis because I'm so crazy, right? Like, I want to kill everybody. You know, she thinks I'm nuts. I call her up. She's like, something wrong with you. So I get together and I do this fifth step. This is what she tells me. She tells me that I've harmed nobody. The only person I've harmed was myself. And the reason I was the way I was is because I didn't bomb with my mother. You know, and I don't know anything about AA, you know what I mean? But I know one thing. I knew that wasn't right. And I knew it was getting crazier. And I wanted to drink. And I wanted to kill her and me and everybody I've seen, right? And I'd call her up every day, and I'd be screaming and crying. I'd be throwing myself all over the kitchen floor, you know. And she says to me one day, she said, I think you need to get a new sponsor. She said, because I think you have something different than me. Thank God she did that, because she does. She's a problem drinker. She stopped drinking, and her life got better. I'm a real alcoholic. I stopped drinking, and my life definitely does not get better. In the meantime, right, I'm staying away from these Baltimore people because I don't want to be destroyed, right? But there's this woman, right? She was from Maryland, and she talked about the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Had no idea that Baltimore's in Maryland. Had no idea that the big book in the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the same thing, I swear to God. And so I was safe with her, right? And she absolutely glowed. And she talked about how she felt like the scum of the earth her whole life. And she didn't feel that way today. And she certainly didn't look that way. So I went up and asked her if she'd be my sponsor. And she asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths. And I said, absolutely. I went to any lengths to drink. And I wasn't breaking the rules of the house, you know what I mean? So I stayed with this woman with the big book, with the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Maryland, right? And this is what she told me. She said, Patty, people have been telling you your whole life if you just stop drinking, you'd be okay. She said, you stop drinking, you are definitely not okay. That drinking has never been my problem. Drinking has always been my solution. Now that my solution stopped working, I needed a new solution, which were the 12 steps of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, what I had was a spiritual malady, and what I needed was a spiritual solution. And we didn't really get too much into step one, because she knew I had step one down. My step two came in that day when I seen her glowing from the podium. I believed that if it could happen for her, maybe it could happen for me. She said I was going to get up every day. I was going to say a third step prayer. I was going to help as many people as I could. And if I couldn't help them, I wasn't to hurt them. She said, next we're going to launch into a vigorous course of action and do this personal inventory. Did that, not doing that. That didn't work out well for me, you know what I mean? Made me worse. Want to kill myself. And everybody around me. But I would. I would get up every morning. I'd say that third step prayer. I go off to work. I was so helpful. They were giving me awards. I come back to the recovery house. I was the mother of the recovery house, you know what I mean? Taking care of everybody. Going off to meetings. Sticking my hand out to somebody who had one day less than me. And I come home and throw myself on the kitchen floor and I'd scream and cry and kick because I wanted to drink so bad. And I believed I didn't because I was helping others. And I couldn't sleep. I had drunk dream after drunk dream after drunk dream. And I really, really missed my kids. And I called her up one day. I said, I don't think this is working. I said, I want to drink so bad. And I'm doing everything you're telling me to do, which I wasn't. But in my mind, I was. And I want to drink. And I can't sleep. And I miss my kids. And I don't understand. How come I can't even just hug my kids just for 5 minutes? And she said, Patty, you don't have to physically hug your kids. God can hug them for you. And I want you to pray about that. And I did everything she told me to do, except for the fourth step. Because I really believed I had wet brain. I had no idea that I didn't have wet brain until I celebrated a year sober and I asked her. Because I was afraid she'd fire me over that. And so that night I did. I prayed. And I fell asleep and I didn't have a drunk dream. I had a dream I walked into a room and all three of my daughters were there. And I could feel them hug me. And then somehow, 2 days later, my middle daughter got my phone number. And she called me. I don't even know how she got my number till this day. And I was telling her about my dream. And she said, oh, my God, Mom, I had the same dream. So if God can bring me and my children together in our dreams, God could do anything. And that obsession was lifted. And I stopped having those drunk dreams, and I did a fourth and fifth step with this woman. And I did it right out of the big book. And I found out I was the problem. I couldn't even freaking believe it, you know what I mean? I was amazed, you know? And my sponsor, she was so smart. She knew not to point out all those things. Because I already felt like I was the worst person in the world. What kind of women just give away their kids so they could drink? You know, who sells their soul to drink? I just felt like the most horrible person in the world. And this is what she told me. She said, Patty, the things you did to you when you were out there doesn't make you who you are. There's things that you did. She said, and I probably needed to do everything I did when I was out there and drink what I did. So when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had to go back out. And she said, all those dirty, disgusting things I thought I did when I was out there were going to be my biggest gifts to help other women. She's absolutely right. I do not regret my fast. And she sent me home to do that hour to review the first 5 proposals, making sure I left nothing out. When I got home to do that, for the first time since that first drink when I was 14, then my head complete silence, even though it was only for a few minutes, you know. And I said that seven-step prayer, and I started making my eight-step list, you know. And a lot of my stuff, my eight-step list didn't come off of my four-step. I harmed way more people than I was resentful at, you know. And at this time, the state of Georgia was looking for me. They wanted me back in Georgia to go in front of a judge for my fifth DUI and total in that truck. And I also got, I had a public drunkenness that I got arrested in my inside the trailer that I had to go back for, too. And she said, and it looked like I was going to have to do about 2 to 3 years. And she said, we really need to get you moving along, get you through the steps. You need to get through some of these amends before you go to jail. And she said, we're going to start with the closest state, and we're going to send you back to Jersey. And I couldn't wait to get back there to make amends to my dad, you know, because I loved him and he was my hero. And he knew I was coming because I call him every week, a couple times a week, you know. And when I set up the arrangements to go see my dad, he said, you know what, Patty, I really believe for the first time in your life that you're going to be okay. He said, I think you got this drink problem solved. And he said, and I'm real tired, and I miss your mother. My mother died when I was 25 from colon cancer. And I just feel like I live a life of a houseplant. And I said, no, Dad, it won't get better. I'm sober now. We'll be able to do things together. And I'm coming to Jersey, you know, do my ninth step with you. He's like, okay. And so I get to Jersey, and I can't find my dad, and he knows I'm coming. Finally, I get in touch with my brother and my sister. My father had a stroke that morning. And he was in critical condition. He was paralyzed and he couldn't talk. And I called my sponsor. I was like, can't do that one. She said, I go, yes, you can. She said, you're going to ask everybody to leave the room. You're not going to tell them you're sorry. You've been sorry your whole life. You're going to tell them you're wrong. And that's what I did. And my dad started to cry. And I said, Dad, you know what? There's a good chance I'll never be that person ever again if I continue doing the things that I'm doing. And my dad managed to say the words, I love you. And he died a week later. And I felt like my dad held on to make sure I was okay before he could go. And I got to make amends with both those hot dog vendors. I was still married. My sponsor was such a bitch, you know what I mean? She, like, made me act like a married woman. So I act like a married woman until I got divorced. Even after that act, you know. And so I got together with both those ex-husbands, and my second ex-husband said to me, he said, you know what, Patty? I really was going to kill you that night. The only reason I didn't kill you is because a bright white light came and hit me in the head and knocked me off of you. The whole time, I always thought God was so far out there, and the whole time I've always been in the palm of God's hands, you know. My sponsor, she bought me a little suit to go to court. We drove out to go in front of this judge whose daughter was killed a year earlier by a drunk driver, and the mayor's mother was killed 10 years earlier by a drunk driver. And my sponsor, my grand sponsor, he said to me, he said, you know what, Patty? The lawyer, the judge, the prosecutor, none of those people are in charge. God's in charge. And if you're supposed to go to jail, that's where you'll go. And you'll carry this message in jail. So I get in front of this judge, and I'm scared, you know. I've only been to jail a couple times. I was pretty loaded, you know. But I was willing, because I never wanted to go back to where I was. So I was willing to do all my amends. And I went in front of this judge, and she gave me 24 hours in jail. You know, and I think God thought it was saw fit best that I carry this message outside than inside the jail. But they took me off in my little suit, right, in handcuffs and brought me to a holding cell, and they took my handcuffs off and let me into the holding cell. So, and there was this prisoner in there. She thought it was a lawyer. I couldn't freaking believe it. She thought it was a lawyer coming to help her. I was like, now I'm going to jail with you, sister. And I spent 24 hours in jail. And that 24 hours, I did talk about the 12 steps, big book in God. And I got back to York, Pennsylvania. I was through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tell you, I was on fire. Now that I was sober in York, Pennsylvania, having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, people in York are going to get sober now. I'm going to make sure of it, right? So I get this apartment. It has high ceilings, right? I'm, like, moving homeless people in, ripping people up off the streets, out of my mind. I had to do community service at this woman's homeless shelter. I had them on their knees in the parking lot doing the third step prayer because people in York, Pennsylvania are going to get sober now. And trying to take people through the steps at work that weren't even alcoholic, out of my freaking mind, right? I got this lumber, right? I was going to build a loft because I had high ceilings. I'm going to start stacking the drunks, and I'm getting sober in New York, Pennsylvania, right? So I have all these crazy people living with me. This is the funnest time of my sobriety, I swear to God. It's so much fun. All these crazy people living with me. They stole everything I owned, and I barely owned anything. Can you imagine? I barely owned anything. And then they stole all my checks, and then they stole my mail. I didn't even know I was bouncing checks with the little money I had, you know? And there was this little girl, right? And she lived with me. And she was 19 years old. She was the same age as my daughter at the time, my oldest daughter at the time. And she didn't want to be sober. And I was, like, making her be sober now, you know what I mean? And nobody wanted to be sober, you know what I mean? I made so many freaking mistakes. The beauty of that is I learned how to effectively sponsor people by making so many mistakes, right? But I come home from work one day, right, and she's gone, and I can't find her. And this drug dealer calls, and he says he has her. And then she's been out for like 2 hours, and I beg him, please bring her home. Actually, my oldest daughter was living with me. My oldest daughter made him bring her to me. And she gets home, and she's crying. She's foaming at the mouth, and she's shallow breathing. And I don't know anything about drugs. I tried the crack, you know what I mean? So I'm scared. So I call the ambulance. The ambulance come. They take her out of the apartment. They bring her into the back of the ambulance. They shoot her in the heart. She comes alive. She's freaking pissed off, right? First of all, that she's alive. Every day I would wake up so pissed off I was still alive. Second of all, that she's not high. They take her off to the hospital. She's in the hospital. She comes back home. She doesn't want to be sober. So one of the hardest things I had to do since I got sober was kick her out. Pack her up, drop her off at a hotel, knowing she's probably going to prostitute herself out that night. And I came to the conclusion that what I was doing was hurting people more than I was helping them. Because what I was doing, I was denying that little girl her pain. Because nobody denied me my pain, because if they did, I wouldn't be here today, you know? And so she's sober today. She is sober today. So, like, I don't have a lot of time left, but I really want to go. So I'm in this area, New York, Pennsylvania, you know what I mean? I'm, like, so freaking fabulous, like I'm dying, you know? So spiritually dying. And I get into my very first real relationship, and I'm madly in love. And we break up, and he starts sleeping with one of my grand sponsees, who's 19 years old, and I'm devastated. And I run to Florida. And I'm a mess, you know? I'm absolutely heartbroken beyond belief. And I'm walking the beaches and I'm crying. And my head's attacking me like when I first got sober. And I don't want to drink, so I start taking over Florida AA. Like, they're like, where did this lunatic come from? You know what I mean? And Sarah was there taking over with me. Taking over meetings, you know what I mean? But I started praying, right? And I started praying when I thought I needed. Was like a new, fabulous, like, AA boyfriend. Like, what I need is, like, a biker. I need an AA biker, fabulous boyfriend, right? A week before I moved there, this guy from Cleveland, Ohio, moved there, the mecca of AA. And he is fabulous, right? And he calls me up and he says, Patty, you want to go for a ride in my Harley? I'm thinking, oh, my God, God loves me the best, right? So I meet him, right? And we're going over the bridges with the palm trees, my hair blowing in the wind, you know what I mean? Holding on to this big biker, thinking, definitely God's favorite. We get down to the beach, right? And he says to me, you want to get pizza? Pizza absolutely is my favorite food in the whole world. I immediately think it's a sign from God. We get in there, right? And we get into the pizza place, and he grabs my hands, and he's holding my hands, and he's looking me lovingly in the eyes. And I'm thinking to myself, he's probably going to ask me to marry him. You know what I mean? And this is what he says to me. He says to me, Patty Burke, I've been watching the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're so busy, you're absolutely dying. And he tore apart the third step, and he showed me how I was still playing God. That I had to stop playing God. Why? Because it didn't work. And I wasn't in charge of those ex-boyfriends, those ex-husbands, the girls I used to sponsor my kids, that God's in charge. And I was still making decisions based on self that later put me in the position to be harmed. How I wound up in Florida. And then he started talking to me about 10 and 11. Was I really doing 10? I was making you do 10. But I really wasn't doing 10. You know, and I really wasn't reviewing my day. And upon awakening, I wasn't reviewing my day. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. And I started to really do that stuff. And the first time in my whole sobriety, I became present right here, right now. You know? And this is what I do know. I do know that God answers all our prayers. All of them. Sometimes He just says it doesn't answer in the way we think. God absolutely sent that guy to me. Not to be my AA boyfriend, but to 12-step me. Because I wouldn't have hurt anybody but him. Because I figured it had to be a biker, you know? And my life is so different now. I have custody of my little granddaughters who are the love of my life, and I love them with all my heart and soul. And if it wasn't for the 12 steps, strong sponsorship, and a God that loves me the best, those little girls would be in foster care somewhere else. But they have a sober nanny today who loves them and takes care of them. My daughter, she has 3 months sober, and her sponsor's here with me tonight. And my friend Anthony and Lizzie drove from Jersey to see me. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it's given me a brand new life and a patched up old life. And for that, I will be forever grateful and never be able to pay Alcoholics Anonymous back for what it's done for me. Thank you for allowing me to come share my story.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.